It's a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Bogumil Baranovsky, based in New York. Bogumil is a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm catering to families and entrepreneurs on both sides of the Atlantic and Pacific. Bogumil has about 15 years of investment experience. He has authored two books, Outsmarting the Crowd, A Value Investor's Guide to Starting, Building, and Keeping a Family Fortune, and most recently, Money, Life, Family, My Handbook, my complete collection of principles on investing, finding work and life balance, and preserving family wealth. This latest book is also the subject of our conversation today. Before we get into the conversation, I would just recommend everyone listening to also have a replay of my conversation with Bogumil at the recent Intelligent Investing in Crisis Mode conference, where Bogumil shared his perspective on this turbulent time we're all living through and how to maintain the right long-term perspective. Bogumil, really look forward to talking to you about your latest book, Money, Life, Family. If we could start off by just having you tell us what inspired you to write the book, please.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, and thank you again for a very kind foreword that you wrote for the book. So I really appreciate it. Thank you again. The idea for the book was really the thought that I wish I had a certain book in my hands when I got interested by investing. And as you might know from our earlier conversations, the one book that really changed my mind and inspired my passion for investing was One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. And then I read a lot of different books, and I found inspiration in Buffett's writing and Munger's ideas and all kinds of places. And the idea for this book was a chance for me to collect all my thoughts, all my inspirations, ideas, but also mistakes, things that I've done on all fronts, not just investing, but designing my life around becoming a better investor and then working with families and entrepreneurs, helping them preserve and grow their wealth. And I thought of it as a book that I wish I had when I was 20. And in the same way, I think it's a book that a lot of people could benefit from at different points of their investment journey. The reader that I had in mind was a wide range of people that, on one hand, want to do it all by themselves and want to learn everything on their own, all the way to people that want to feel empowered to ask the right questions when they work with professionals managing their money. And a big portion, a third of the book, is devoted to family and thinking of your wealth as something that can serve not just you, but the next generations, which is the core of our business, working with multi-generational wealth and first-generation wealth creators that are thinking ahead and planning for the next few generations, how what they created could help and empower the following generation. So I have a wide spectrum of readers in mind. And the feedback that I received that really made it all worth it is all kinds of stories when I hear that the book travels across families and people pass it along up the generations, down the generations, from grandparents to grandkids and the other way around. And it's fascinating to see and hear all those stories, how the book takes a life of its own and inspires people and makes a difference in their life.
Well, it is an inspiring book, and it takes a broad approach to much more than just making money and investing. And some of these topics, of course, we had the chance to address at the Zurich Project as well. Tell us a little bit more about the core messages of the book, please.
So there are really three big pieces to the book. So the first part, money, talks about the idea of making money with money, which is to me the essence of investing, the ability to deploy your savings and have those savings grow by investing in stocks, which I see as pieces of businesses. And the idea is not really to win any short-term race and be the best performing manager or investor in any quarter or a month, but thinking in terms of growing your wealth over a long period of time, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, a lifetime, or multiple generations. And the big lesson, apart from making money, which is so appealing to people, is the essence for a lot of investors, which is not losing it all. And I think in a time like this right now, when we're looking at a market crash, a potential recession in April 2020, when we were talking, the idea that you could also lose money investing is something that a lot of us have forgotten. And in a way, that has come to the forefront of everybody's attention, that investing is not just a way to grow money and make money, but it's also a place where you could lose more than you can afford to lose. The clients that we work with, we always assume that the money that's with us, it's the money they can't afford to lose. But at the same time, it's not the money they need every day, which gives us a chance to be truly disciplined, patient, long-term value investors. So that's the essence of the first part of the book. The middle of the book is, that I called Life, is a way to redesign your life that will make you a better investor. And these are my own experiences and observations. Investing on its own, it's a very hard pursuit. It takes a lot of effort and patience and self-discipline. And I had a lot of observations, revelations that actually have helped me make changes in the way I live my life, in the way I invest, that make it easier for me. So I talk about the idea of being remote in three ways: physically, intellectually, and emotionally. And I explain how the best ideas that I found investing, they didn't actually come to me when I was sitting behind a desk. Most of them actually came when I was traveling, talking to people, seeing the world around me, visiting stores, talking to business owners. That's where the ideas come from. So being away from your desk, I call it world bound. The second point in that section of the book, I talk about original thinking. So when you're an investor, you actually have to go in and buy stocks when other people don't like them. That's when you get the best value for the lowest price. And unfortunately, that's something that's very hard to do when you're part of a crowd, when you're part of a group, when you have to find consensus, you're part of a committee. In a way, being an investor requires you to go against everybody else and have an opinion of your own. So if you can set up your life in a way where you can actually hear your own thoughts and you're not just following whatever people say, can dramatically improve the quality of your ideas, and it can give you the strength to actually to stick to your ideas, which leads me to the third part of the middle of the book, which I call emotionally remote. There's so much noise out there, and I talked about it at one of your events in Zurich. The idea of unplugging is a big part of that section. So making a conscious decision to disconnect from all the noise out there. Once you buy a great idea, great stock, and you buy it at the right price, believe it or not, but over the next few years when you're holding that stock, there are so many ways that you can talk your way out of holding it. And there will be so many very smart opinions out there that will convince you to sell it. So creating that kind of an emotional wall around you so you don't give the outside noises a chance to talk you out of an idea has served me really well investing. So the middle of the book is all the things that I found very helpful that allow me to become a better investor. The third part of the book, I talk about the family. And here I talk about the idea of creating the best life possible for the next generations. And that's inspired by the work that we do, managing family fortunes and working with entrepreneurs and first generation wealth creators and people that inherited wealth. I've done a study of family fortunes around the world, across different continents, across centuries. And I was curious about any situations or circumstances that allowed family fortunes to continue generation after generation. So obviously there are all kinds of exceptions, but then you start to see patterns that repeat. And there are certain three qualities that I talk about and go more in depth that helped historically
improve the odds of success of not only keeping, but also growing a family fortune over generations. So the number one was the location where the wealth was located. And the second one was the right investment medium. You can own all kinds of assets. You can keep all the money in cash. You can keep it in businesses. And the last part is the idea that it might have taken a one individual to create the wealth, but it always has taken the entire family to preserve it over time, which is a major change in mindset that we see with our clients that we work with, how you might have one individual that created the wealth, but you really need to give a chance to a larger part of the family to help participate in preserving that wealth, because that individual needs help and needs to invite the rest of the family to help and guide the process throughout generations. So this part of the book discusses all the lessons I've learned from working with clients across various continents, but also from my research of families across centuries. What have they done and what we can learn from them? What can history teach us when we're looking ahead? The fascinating thing is that big wealth, or wealth in general that's passed on from generation to generation, used to be a concern of a small percent of population. But nowadays, over the last few decades, we not only witnessed one of the largest wealth creations in history, but we will also witness one of the biggest wealth transfers between generations in the coming decades. So a lot more families, whether it's a small nest egg or a huge fortune, will be facing the same concerns, challenges, and opportunities than the wealthiest families of all time. So the book has three different parts, and they overlap and build on top of each other. And they give me and any reader a more comprehensive idea of how investing can play a role in your life, in managing your family wealth, and then also redesigning your life to benefit you as an investor.
Why is it so difficult to preserve and grow wealth through the generations? I mean, there are very few examples of where that has been done successfully over many generations, it seems.
Well, if you're standing still and you have a humongous fortune in front of you, there's so much working against you, especially when you extend the time period into decades and centuries. So it's not necessarily the obvious things like inflation and taxation, but it also is how the money is being used and spent or invested. And a lot of the challenges that families have actually could be solved by involving the whole family in the conversation and showing how you can put that money to work. Obviously, when I talk about the investment medium, from my experience and the experience of the families that we worked with, investing that capital in income-producing assets, which we see as businesses, stocks, that gives that capital a chance to become a lasting wealth that can grow. Now, I talk about a lot about location, and it might be also inspired by my own personal experience. I was born in Poland in the 1980s under communism, and it was a time where there was no respect for property rights. So you couldn't actually own things, and the government didn't really protect your property rights. So keeping wealth and passing wealth was under a lot of constraint. And that opened my eyes to looking at different examples. And I talk about two families that were based in Cuba that owned two different rum brands. And one actually had assets outside of Cuba when Fidel took over. And the other one had all their assets in Cuba. And the family that had assets outside of Cuba was able to continue and grow their wealth, the Bacardi family. And the family that was behind Havana Club was not able to do it. And it's a prime example of the right location or hedging your location in a way that allows you to endure in times when the political and the economic circumstances change. And just the essence of you being able to preserve wealth, which is the property rights, is being suspended for a long period of time, and you don't own your assets anymore. One family had an option to continue. The other family lost it and continued legal fights to restore their ownership and had very mixed success with it over the years. So it's one of many examples of certain choices that were made by various families that allowed them to endure or not.
What are some of the best practices around creating, let's say, a family office, loosely defined? In other words, kind of delegating responsibility for the family wealth to people within the family. How should that be done ideally?
So there are probably many different ways to go about it. I can talk more about the experience that we've had. So in our case, we work with a number of multi-generational fortunes that have been around for decades, and in some cases, probably close to a century. And the lessons that we've learned, both from the families and the families are learning with us, is that you have to find the best people to take care of your wealth. And not only that, but you have to be on the same page in terms of the objectives that you have for the family wealth. And that's the essence of how we invest and how we look at the wealth that they have and how we think of not taking immense risks that could put the fortunate in a position where they could lose it all. Now, the interesting thing is that when you mentioned the term family office, it's something that has existed for a long time, but somehow came to the forefront of everybody's attention. But family wealth and family fortunes and managing family wealth over generations has existed as long as family wealth to that extent has been around. Now, there are various ways of doing it. Some family offices are basically just the admins, and then they allocate assets to outside managers. In our case, we have the full equity mandate for the families that we work with. And in some cases, we manage the entire fortune that they have. In some cases, we manage a portion of it. They might have some real estate assets outside of what we manage, outside of the equity mandate, that we're not involved in. Sometimes they have their own in-house family expertise on the real estate side. Sometimes they have other managers managing it. So what we do is depends on where the family, how it's positioned, what it needs. But we focus on the investment side. I have mixed feelings about the idea of allocating assets to many managers. It's a practice that we've seen. It has its benefits because it shows that you might be diversifying away and you have many managers, but I think it gets the essence of what has to be done gets a little bit lost. I think if you are lucky enough to find the right managers that are on the same page and can help you manage that fortune over generations, and it's not a manager that's trying to win any short-term races, it's a manager that will not risk it all and help you grow it over time, it's the best thing that you can do. I also see that it's not that easy to find the right manager to manage family wealth in an industry that's changing a lot. The whole investment world is changing to a very short-term focus, and it's a whole topic that we can talk about. But my impression is that not only the investment managers are being measured in so many situations, very short-term based on months and quarters, which makes it almost impossible to have a patient, long-term discipline, value investing approach. There's a conflict there between what the expectations are and how managers are being evaluated. So I think finding the right client base and then finding the right manager is the success. Now, the fascinating thing is that I think in a time like this today, you know, April 2020, when we're seeing market corrections, so many companies asking for bailouts, It's a time that shows how vulnerable the system is, how fragile it is, and how even big corporations don't have a rainy fund in place that can let them get through a few months of no earnings. And after a massive obsession with short-term results, I was actually reading something interesting, how the tenure of a CEO has been coming down and down and down to under 5 years. So when you look from the top to the bottom, or the bottom to the top, which way you want to look, but if you have a shareholder that wants to see quick results, a client that wants to see quick results, and the CEO that has to show quick results,
buybacks come to place. You want to show earnings per share growth as fast as possible. And you do what, as a good example, airlines did and spent $50 billion on buybacks in the last 10 years. And now they're asking for a $50 billion bailout. Well, the immediate thought would be, why wouldn't you save that $50 billion for a rainy day like today? You wouldn't have to ask for it, for help. So it shows you how the short-term thinking is affecting how money is invested. Family wealth is not a short-term money approach. So clients that we work with, they don't really care if we beat the benchmark every month or every quarter. They actually see that if we do that, we have to be taking risks that are just not acceptable for the family wealth. So bottom line, short answer, the right client, the right manager, and the right combination of the two, and an honest conversation of the goals for the two sides. I think it's the essence of success of families. The families that we work with, we were lucky to be working with them. And I think they were lucky to have managers like us that are on the same page. And I think honesty about how you think about investing, if you're really on the same page, I think it's the success recipe for both the family and the money manager.
It must be difficult sometimes to reconcile within a family different approaches or different goals. Some family members may want to spend more money, others may want to take a more conservative approach to saving and investing it. How do those kinds of questions get resolved?
Well, there are all kinds of questions that come up, and you and I talked about communication, and we over-communicate at times, and we have fascinating meetings when we sit around the table, and sometimes our role is just to listen. And I think it's something that we're all learning how we can listen better in all kinds of professions. But I think in the investment profession, sometimes it matters more than anything else to just listen. And there are all kinds of examples that I can talk about in very general terms, but in some cases we have a family pool, a family capital managed as a whole, as one, with one objective for the next generations. And then we accommodate sub-accounts or separate accounts for individual family members, because we're all individuals and every family consists of individuals, as you said, that has different goals, different objectives. They're at a different point of their life with different needs and different tolerance for risk. And so in many ways, and that comes up in many conversations, it's better to have one shared pool that's meant to serve the following generations that are not even around yet, and then have individual accounts for individual family members so that we can more accommodate their needs and be on the same page with what they want, which allows us to avoid certain frictions that could happen if we're trying to keep everybody on the same page, which can happen, but everybody is different. And the ages are different and the needs are different. So as much as we can accommodate that, we do that, because that helps keep clients happy.
Shifting gears to the middle portion of the book, where you talk about designing the right kind of life, could you share some more specific advice for how one can go about structuring one's life to enable investing well, as well as living well?
So one big tip that I would share that's actionable, and it's easy to, not easy to do, but it's simple in a way. It's just limiting the amount of news and information that one consumes. When I started as an analyst 15 years ago, and I was under the impression that I have to know everything. And I think that's something that a lot of investors that I know, that I'm friends with, that was their challenge, because you're under the impression that you have to know everything. The oil price drops, you have to know everything, why it does what it does, and understand the whole context. And then the copper price is going up and you have to understand, and the food prices are falling and this is moving and that's moving. And in the investment world, everything is moving all the time. Now, having the ability to, in a way, limit the amount of information that is coming your way can dramatically improve your investment results. So for me, it's creating a constraint. So there are big parts of the market that I don't follow, and I'm not aware of what's going on, which actually confuses a lot of people. People ask me about some random stock and they say, what do you think about it? And I say, I've never looked at it. I don't know what they do. And it shocks them because they think I should have an opinion about everything out there, and I don't. I would rather have a very good in-depth understanding of the 30, 50 businesses that we own and another 50 that we would like to own if the price was right, than have an opinion about everything that's out there. I actually consciously consume very little news. I want to know what the headlines are, of course, and I want to be aware of the big things that are happening, but I spend much more time going in depth and understanding one industry, one business, one story at a time, and limiting the noise out there. It's pretty much impossible to keep up with all the news out there. And in my early days as an analyst, I used to sign up for every single newsletter, go to every single conference, take every possible meeting, take every possible call. And it was great in a way because I was able to learn a lot really fast, but it also gave me a chance to see what are the segments of the market, what are the stocks, what are the businesses, what are the stories that I should follow more closely and not get as diluted and dilute my attention on trying to know everything. So that would be the number one thing for me, just limit the amount of input coming in because it's impossible to process everything.
Well, that's a great point. You also talked about kind of disconnecting, and that has to do with not following the news. Do you have any routines around how you structure your day or how often you engage with, digital media, email, and things like that?
So I believe that technology can empower us to do incredible things. And just the fact that you and I are talking, you're in Switzerland, I'm actually in the woods in Pennsylvania in a cabin. And it always blows me away what technology allows us to do. But I think we should see this as a tool that empowers us instead of something that imprisons us. And when I turn on my computer, I could be getting alerts and all the news and all the noise all the time and actually not even finish one single email all day because I would be trying to keep up with it. I actually turn off all the alerts on my phone. So there's nothing popping up on my phone. I want to have the least distraction and stimulation throughout the day so I can focus on long form. When I say long form, I would rather spend an hour or two reading an annual report than trying to keep up with the latest of the latest of why somebody believes the market is up or down today. The funny thing is, and it may disappoint or inspire some people, is that if you ask me in the middle of the day, on any random day, if the market was up or down today when we meet for lunch, in most cases, I wouldn't even know because it doesn't really help me. Now, what helps me is knowing exactly what I own and why we own it, what kind of businesses we own. And it came to the forefront of all the discussions actually right now, April 2020, when the market was falling and we had a lot of calls with clients and we were over communicating in many ways. But one of the things that we talked about is the fact that what we don't own matters as much as what we do own. And the fact that we know exactly what we own and we know how those businesses can be performing in all kinds of stressful situations, what the managements are doing, that gave me much more confidence and peace of mind and helped our clients through this time than me letting them know that I kept up with every single news beat that was coming through every single day the last few weeks or any other week, as a matter of fact. So being very selective. And in terms of routines, I'm very productive in the mornings and I'm very productive in the afternoons. So the middle, I like to do things that are less engaging. And ideally, in the last few weeks, my routine has been to just go for a walk in the middle of the day. I think it helps me recharge my batteries and I come back with a clear mind and it gives me a fresh perspective on things. So breaking up my day into two pieces, that has been very helpful in terms of routines.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you. And now coming to part one of the book, just briefly, I think you presciently presented actually an idea at Best Ideas 2018 about the short high yield debt ETF, and basically, you know, pointed to a lot of the excesses that have come to roost recently. The question I have now in terms of making money with money is the question of nominal versus real returns going forward. Yes. I think, you know, we haven't really had to pay much attention to that over the last couple of decades, but that's not necessarily an indication of what's to come. So how do you think about that topic, because you are responsible for multi-generational wealth, and the issue of nominal versus real is a very important one in that context?
Well, it's a great question. It could be a whole separate discussion. And I look at it this way. So when I have conversations with my colleagues that grew up in the US, I grew up in Poland in the 80s. I moved to New York when I was in my 20s. I lived in Paris for a while. But as a kid and when I was a teenager, we went through hyperinflation in Poland. And hyperinflation is something that you have to live through to understand it. Because I talked about it to friends and I tried to explain what it felt like when prices are going up and zeros are being added by the day, and your parents are really rushing to spend the money because it loses value so quickly that by the time they get the paycheck, it's not really the same money. It's such a disruptive force in managing not only your home budget, household budget, but also in running a business. You can't even imagine the supply chain and inventory management in a time where the value of what you're holding on the balance sheet is different at the beginning and the end of the month, and you want to get rid of it as fast as possible, and every day of sales of inventory that you're holding, it matters. It's so disruptive in the way the credit works in a hyperinflationary world. So when I talk to colleagues, and you know, some of them that are older, they say, well, in the 70s, there was some inflation in the US. That's true, but hyperinflation, it's something that it's mind-boggling. Now, what we're seeing and what you're touching on is the idea that, you know, the debt levels are very high, we're printing money. And I think where you were going with it is all that is happening right now that we see as help. So not only bailouts, but also the Federal Reserve participating in the markets and really distorting the pricing mechanism in big portions of the market, not just treasuries or the investment grade bonds, but also the non-investment, the junk bond market. Now, that's the reality, and so far, allegedly, there are no consequences, but if you're thinking about family wealth or any nest egg that you have, and you're thinking about spending the nest egg in the next 10, 20, 50 years, you might have to think about the purchasing power of that money, which is something we didn't have to think for a while in Europe or here in the US or in most of the countries. Now, the idea that a million is no longer a million, it's something that's very hard to grasp. Now, there are some ways and some tools that we can all use to preserve that purchasing power. Now, my preferred way is owning businesses. If you own businesses that have pricing power, which is something that Buffett talks a lot about, and it's something that somehow we own, it's not the number one thing that people think about, but if you have a business that has a pricing power, he talks about See's Candy a lot. If your end customer doesn't care that you raise prices every year, that kind of business can actually have a better odds of success and endurance through a period of rising prices, because that business is able to pass on the rising costs of doing business and still maintain margins. It's hugely disruptive for everyone, including a business like this. But if it does have a pricing power, it can weather the storm and be lifted out of that trouble. So if you can find quality businesses that have that ability, that's a great way to improve your odds of maintaining and growing your purchasing power over time. Now, the second thing that we also considered and we've used is some sort of a gold holding. And, you know, historically for the last few thousand years, except for the last 50, metal, precious metal, gold was actually the currency. And anytime things got out of hand and we printed too much money or we were spending too much money and inflation caught up with us, whether it's Germany in the 1920s, but it was also Poland in the 1920s. Because of Germany, it spilled over. At that time, to restore a currency, that currency was always linked back, in case of Poland, it was linked back to the dollar and really to gold, how many ounces of gold each unit of currency represented. Now, the fascinating thing is that we forgot about it, but when you're watching what's happening with the gold price, you can see that there is a portion of investors that see gold as the ultimate currency in times like this. So short answer, the best way to preserve your purchasing power is owning businesses that have pricing power, and you can consider gold ownership, a gold holding, as another way to also protect your purchasing power over time.
And one kind of conventional piece of advice, I think, is often to have a balance of stocks and bonds. Now, when you look at bonds, and back to this idea of making money with money, you've got long-dated government bonds, for example, at basically 0% interest. Now, that doesn't sound like making money with money, and especially if you end up with the same amount of nominal currency in 20 or 30 years, it certainly does not sound like a way to preserve purchasing power.
No, it's one of the biggest challenges for a lot of investors and clients that are asking about income. And that's a question that comes up, and they say, you had $1 million back in the day, and actually not that long ago, in 2007, I remember a one-year CD with Citibank, a major bank, was paying 5%, a one-year CD, a certificate of deposit. It was paying 5%. So $1 million will give you a $50,000 income. That's real money. Now, it's very hard to get a 5% yield, especially when the Fed is participating in the junk bond market right now. So bonds are, by definition, the most expensive, or I know, as expensive as they get, unless we push yields to the negative territory, which is something that Europe is practicing these days. We're basically distorting a pricing mechanism that should tell us what the equation between the risk and the reward is. Now, the fascinating thing for me is that when I was 10, 11, Poland wanted to rejoin the international trade and the international institutions and the currency. They wanted to make it convertible again. And one of the things that the IMF asked the local government was two things, really. One is you can't print money and you can't be spending at the levels that you are spending. You can't have the central bank funding deficits. And that was the way, or the only condition, the main condition for Poland to rejoin the world currency exchange. You can't print money. You can't use central bank to fund your deficits. Now, it's been 30 years, and I'm sitting here in the U.S., and the Federal Reserve is doing exactly what the failed Polish Communist Central Bank was doing 30 years ago. It would be something fascinating for a historian to talk about and analyze, but Mark Twain said that history rhymes. I think it's a familiar rhyme to me, and unfortunately, it's maybe the things that I observed and had a chance to experience can help me make smarter decisions now. But in terms of immediate choices, I would avoid bonds as a long-term place for your money. Now, you have to see the difference between long-term and short-term here, because if you're waiting for investment opportunities, I have nothing against holding cash. We actually went into this market correction with a disproportionate amount of cash and some market protection
some of it in gold and some of it in VIX ETF, which actually has performed very well when the volatility spiked up. Now, that cash will not be sitting idle for a long time, and we'd like to put it to work. So in terms of short term, I think it's fine if you're holding cash when you're waiting for investment opportunities. But if you were thinking in terms of decades and you wanted to put all your money or a substantial part of your money in, you know, 30-year bonds or cash, that might not be the best recipe for maintaining or purchasing power given all that's been going on. Now, the monetary and fiscal experiment that we're going through, it's probably in terms of proportions the biggest ever. I don't know if you want to look at the size of the economy or relative to the size of the economy, but I think we've never had so much trust in institutions. And that would be for me the one singular reason why we got away with so much in terms of the trillions of dollars of being printed and spent. It's money that's created out of nowhere. And we all know that the basic economics that I still think apply in the long run is that if too much money is chasing too few goods, it eventually catches up with you. You never know when, you never know how, but just reminiscing on my hyperinflation experience from childhood, once it happens, it's so sudden, so big, and so disorienting for everyone that it takes quite a while to reinstate trust in money, which is something that we're taking for granted.
And it's interesting that a lot of people presume that one requires a strong economy in order for this to happen. But many of the economies where there was hyperinflation were not strong economies at all.
No, not at all. Initially, you think that you can buy prosperity with more money. There's a confusion because we think it's the same money that existed before. Now, as long as there is a limited supply of money, and money used to be tied to gold, and gold grows at 2%, the supply of gold grows 2% every year, and there's not much that we can do to speed it up, that money, we can have trust in it, that it buys the same amount of goods today, tomorrow, and 5 years from now. Now, if you have a central bank that's creating at no cost a limited amount of money, and that's a very different world we live in. So initially, you fool participants into believing that's the same money with the same purchasing power. But at some point, and again, we never know when, somebody calls them out on it and says it's not the same money. And it happened over and over again. I think China actually had the most experience with paper money over the last few thousand years. And we also had debasements of currencies, including the Roman Empire, Venice, and other examples in history. Even the Greeks debased their currencies. And that's something that we've done before. And every time we think that we can fool people into believing it's the same money they're dealing with. Now, we're not even debasing a metal currency. We're creating paper money out of nothing. To me, the most mind-blowing idea is that it's almost impossible to make more toilet paper. That's why we have locally in some places right now toilet paper shortages. But we can create trillions of dollars with no effort. It makes you think what has more value, something that we can create that quickly or something that we can create in an unlimited way with a keystroke. But that's, you know, that's a fascinating thing to think about.
Absolutely. Bogomil, you have now written two books. You write wonderful articles periodically, and I'd encourage everyone listening to get on that email list if possible. I think there's a way to sign up on the CCARD website or perhaps by getting in touch with yourself. Where I'm going with this is, before we wrap it up, I'd love it if you told us a little bit about your writing process and how you managed to be so prolific.
That's very kind of you to say. I love writing. I feel like it gives me a chance to organize my thoughts. So I write a lot, and it helps me when I think of specific investments. I feel like there's a big difference between you and I talking and me telling you I like the stock and me actually sitting down and organizing my thoughts so that I could present it to someone in a minute or two and show them why this is an interesting idea. I think it improves your discipline as a thinker and investor. Also, when I see it on paper, it's easier for me to poke holes in my thinking. And the last piece is that we have a certain bias looking back. All of us do, or I do. I think everybody does. That going back, we always think that we knew something. I remember having fascinating conversations with people that were telling me that they knew that March of 2009 was the bottom of the market and the market will only go up for the next 10 years from there. I was actually in a meeting with very smart people and one of the cold winter evenings in March, few days before the market bottomed, and nobody had a single stock recommendation. Everybody said what you just said, it's not a good investment, I agree, which is treasuries. Everybody said, let's buy treasuries. That was March of 2009. So when people tell me now that they knew the market was at the bottom, I don't want to make the same mistake with my own thinking. So I like to write down what I thought at the time. And I keep sort of a market diary where I write down things that I thought at the time. And it helps me go back and find holes in my thinking. And I'm much more fascinated with my own mistakes than with the success stories, because I feel like if I can only avoid some of the mistakes, I think the good ones, the good stories, the good stocks will take care of themselves. But finding the weaknesses, finding the mistakes, and keeping a good track of them, I think that's very helpful. But in terms of writing, I just sit down and whatever is on my mind, I write. A lot of what I write never, the public never sees. But the good pieces that I spend more time on and I'd like to share, I post on our website, Sicard Associates, that I recommend everybody to check out. And there is a way on the website to sign up and get our weekly, biweekly articles. These days, we've been writing more because there's more things to talk about and more questions. And it looks like every week is a month long. So there has been a lot more to talk about. And a lot of the things I write about are inspired by questions that I get from clients. And it's a two-way street. I feel like I'm learning from them, they're learning from me, but whatever I find that's worth sharing and it's okay to share, I put in the articles.
Terrific. Well, Bogomil, this has been a great conversation, very helpful. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Wonderful. Thank you again for having me, and everybody stay safe and good luck. Enjoy your investing.
And the book, once again, is Money, Life, Family, my handbook. It's available on Amazon, and I highly recommend that everyone have a read. Goodbye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.